Hello. This is the IGCSE English as a Second Language, Paper 2, Listening, the 2nd of May, 2007. This test is in three parts. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. In this section, you will hear a teacher in England giving a talk to parents and students about next year's school exchange trip to Germany. Listen and answer the questions below. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good evening. My name is Mrs. Green, the head of German, and I'd like to welcome you to this parents' evening about next year's exchange trip to Germany, which your son or daughter will be going on. This evening, I want to give you details of the programme, some information about the school your child will be attending in Germany, and details of host families. I'll also advise you of our policy on behaviour during the trip. The trip is from the 12th to the 24th of March, and students will be back here in class on Monday the 26th. The group used to travel to Germany by coach and ferry, but this year the journey will be much shorter, as it's by plane from London to Hamburg, followed by a one-hour coach drive to Nordstadt. The whole journey takes only 2.5 hours, which means that students will arrive early afternoon instead of late evening. They will first go to the Schiller High School, where they will meet their German partner and family, and be taken to their host family's home. As you know, the trip lasts for 12 days, including the travelling. For the first 3 days, students will be attending classes at Schiller High School and getting a taste of the German school system. They will attend the same classes as their partner. So, for example, if their partner has a chemistry lesson, our student will go along to that class. As you may be aware, German school students do not wear a uniform, so our students will be expected to wear appropriate clothes. These should be smart, casual clothes, and can include trousers for girls. The important thing is to use common sense. Another thing to remind your child about is that in Germany, the school day begins at 8 a.m. and finishes at 1 p.m. So, on their first morning in Germany, they should expect to get up at 6 a.m. This is the normal time for getting up on a school day. The remaining days, the students will be visiting Bremen University, which runs a wide range of courses for international students. They will also spend a day in Lübeck, a town on the Baltic coast where marzipan is made. The highlight of the trip will be a day's excursion to Hamburg. Students will visit its famous fun fair and have lunch by the lake and take a boat trip around the harbour. Other informal get-togethers are also organised, such as shopping trips and an evening at a bowling centre. At the weekend, students will be left to their own devices and will have a chance to relax and get to know their host families a bit better, with the opportunity of practicing their German language skills and experiencing German culture. Please be assured that the accommodation offered by the host families has been checked and approved by the German high school staff, and every child will be in their own separate bedroom. Some will also have their own bathroom. All of these families come highly recommended, and many of them have hosted our students before. Your child will be a guest in the host family's house, and we expect them to behave appropriately. Life within a German family is, as a rule, very relaxed, but the host families have been asked to tell students bedtimes and when they're expected to be home. They have also been advised to apply a zero-tolerance policy on smoking with our students. 35 students will be going on the trip this time, and they will be accompanied by 3 of our school staff, all of whom are German speakers. These staff will accompany the group on all organised trips and will be present at the Schiller High School during school hours. Should your child have a problem when the staff are not available, they can always be contacted by mobile phone. Each member of staff will carry one. The numbers will be provided to students and to you, the parents, nearer the time. The German exchange has become an increasingly popular trip, as well as a tremendous support to the students' studies. We hope that this trip will be a great success, as it has been in previous years. We are increasing the amount of German being taught in school, and this is an ideal opportunity to build on work in the classroom. For those of you with children in years 7, 8 and 9, the trip to Germany will be both helpful and interesting. For year 10 students, there is the added advantage of the opportunity to practice before the oral exam in their final year. So now, if you have any questions, I will be happy to answer them.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Good evening. My name is Mrs. Green, the head of German, and I'd like to welcome you to this parents' evening about next year's exchange trip to Germany, which your son or daughter will be going on. This evening, I want to give you details of the programme, some information about the school your child will be attending in Germany, and details of host families. I'll also advise you of our policy on behaviour during the trip. The trip is from the 12th to the 24th of March, and students will be back here in class on Monday the 26th. The group used to travel to Germany by coach and ferry, but this year the journey will be much shorter, as it's by plane from London to Hamburg, followed by a one-hour coach drive to Nordstadt. The whole journey takes only 2.5 hours, which means that students will arrive early afternoon instead of late evening. They will first go to the Schiller High School, where they will meet their German partner and family and be taken to their host family's home. As you know, the trip lasts for 12 days, including the travelling. For the first 3 days, students will be attending classes at Schiller High School and getting a taste of the German school system. They will attend the same classes as their partner. So, for example, if their partner has a chemistry lesson, our student will go along to that class. As you may be aware, German school students do not wear a uniform, so our students will be expected to wear appropriate clothes. These should be smart, casual clothes, and can include trousers for girls. The important thing is to use common sense. Another thing to remind your child about is that in Germany, the school day begins at 8 a.m. and finishes at 1 p.m. So, on their first morning in Germany, they should expect to get up at 6 a.m. This is the normal time for getting up on a school day. The remaining days, the students will be visiting Bremen University, which runs a wide range of courses for international students. They will also spend a day in Lübeck, a town on the Baltic coast where marzipan is made. The highlight of the trip will be a day's excursion to Hamburg. Students will visit its famous fun fair and have lunch by the lake and take a boat trip around the harbour. Other informal get-togethers are also organised, such as shopping trips and an evening at a bowling centre. At the weekend, students will be left to their own devices and will have a chance to relax and get to know their host families a bit better, with the opportunity of practicing their German language skills and experiencing German culture. Please be assured that the accommodation offered by the host families has been checked and approved by the German high school staff, and every child will be in their own separate bedroom. Some will also have their own bathroom. All of these families come highly recommended, and many of them have hosted our students before. Your child will be a guest in the host family's house, and we expect them to behave appropriately. Life within a German family is, as a rule, very relaxed, but the host families have been asked to tell students bedtimes and when they're expected to be home. They have also been advised to apply a zero-tolerance policy on smoking with our students. 35 students will be going on the trip this time, and they will be accompanied by 3 of our school staff, all of whom are German speakers. These staff will accompany the group on all organised trips and will be present at the Schiller High School during school hours. Should your child have a problem when the staff are not available, they can always be contacted by mobile phone. Each member of staff will carry one. The numbers will be provided to students and to you, the parents, nearer the time. The German exchange has become an increasingly popular trip, as well as a tremendous support to the students' studies. We hope that this trip will be a great success, as it has been in previous years. We are increasing the amount of German being taught in school, and this is an ideal opportunity to build on work in the classroom. For those of you with children in years 7, 8 and 9, the trip to Germany will be both helpful and interesting. For year 10 students, there is the added advantage of the opportunity to practice before the oral exam in their final year. So now, if you have any questions, I will be happy to answer them.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. Harry Robinson, a champion rower, is being interviewed by a journalist about his favourite teacher. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Thank you, Harry, for coming in today to talk about your favourite teacher.
I'm delighted to be here.
So, firstly, why was this person important to you?
If it hadn't been for my English teacher, Glenn Johnson, I would never have got into a boat. He started an after-school rowing club at my secondary school and asked me to give it a go.
Were you already showing signs of being a great sportsman then?
I have always loved sport and was a good all-rounder at school. I was okay at rugby and cricket and a good sprinter and ran in school competitions at regional level. Academically, though, I didn't do particularly well. At primary school, I came bottom of the class in tests, but it didn't worry me. I'm dyslexic and have had problems with reading all my life. I'd had extra lessons at primary school, and when I went to secondary school, I was taken out of French to do extra English. Although I wish I'd been excused maths and science as well, as those subjects never appealed either.
Tell me about Glenn.
Glenn Johnson only taught me for 1 year. He seemed very strict, but people weren't scared of him. They admired him. He was short-sighted, so we learned early on that if you were causing mischief in the class, he would walk up to your desk and stare at you. You knew then you were in trouble. Glenn's two loves were rugby and rowing, and he helped with a number of sporting activities and was hugely enthusiastic and wanted us all to enjoy what we did.
Could you tell me about the early days?
I was about 13 when I began rowing. At first, there were 12 of us, but soon we were down to 4 in the under-14 group. After 2 or 3 months of rowing up and down the river, Glenn asked us if we would like to take part in a race, and we competed in the district school's regatta and won. Mm. We entered 7 events in our first season and won them all. We thought we were invincible. I was the biggest and the strongest, so I led the team, but I never saw myself as the captain. We were all in it together.
What was the training schedule like?
We trained every day after school, and sometimes at lunchtime in school as well, doing weights and stuff like that. Glenn made it all seem like fun. It was never a chore. He was cunning. Sometimes, when we had to do a run around the block, we didn't always go the full distance. He knew what was going on, but never said anything. Instead, next time, he'd take us in his car and drop us off somewhere so that we had no alternative but to run all the way back to school or the rowing club. Afterwards, he always dropped us off at our houses so we could get our homework done ready for the next school day.
So, what was the secret of his success?
The reason we did so well, I later discovered, was that we did more training than any of the other competitors. During the season, we rowed every weekday, had Saturdays off, and then rowed on Sunday mornings. During the winter, we went training with a local rowing club, Tuesday and Thursday evenings. Glenn Johnson taught us discipline. People like doing things they are good at, and that are fun. And the professional way he organised things to make it easy for us, and fun as well, was impressive. In the coaching I do now, I hope I come across in the same way, trying to get people to achieve their potential without flogging them so they hate it and never want to come back to sport once they finish school.
Are you still in contact with him?
Yes. Glenn and I became friends and are still in touch. I see him regularly at school reunions, and sometimes we meet for lunch. He's a great guy. He's been retired for some time now, but he doesn't look any different from when I started rowing in 1976.
Thanks, Harry, for coming in and talking to me today.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Thank you, Harry, for coming in today to talk about your favourite teacher.
I'm delighted to be here.
So, firstly, why was this person important to you?
If it hadn't been for my English teacher, Glenn Johnson, I would never have got into a boat. He started an after-school rowing club at my secondary school and asked me to give it a go.
Were you already showing signs of being a great sportsman then?
I have always loved sport and was a good all-rounder at school. I was okay at rugby and cricket and a good sprinter, and ran in school competitions at regional level. Academically, though, I didn't do particularly well. At primary school, I came bottom of the class in tests, but it didn't worry me. I'm dyslexic, and have had problems with reading all my life. I'd had extra lessons at primary school, and when I went to secondary school, I was taken out of French to do extra English. Although I wish I'd been excused maths and science as well, as those subjects never appealed either.
Tell me about Glenn.
Glenn Johnson only taught me for 1 year. He seemed very strict, but people weren't scared of him. They admired him. He was short-sighted, so we learned early on that if you were causing mischief in the class, he would walk up to your desk and stare at you. You knew then you were in trouble. Glenn's two loves were rugby and rowing, and he helped with a number of sporting activities and was hugely enthusiastic and wanted us all to enjoy what we did.
Could you tell me about the early days?
I was about 13 when I began rowing. At first, there were 12 of us, but soon we were down to 4 in the under-14 group. After 2 or 3 months of rowing up and down the river, Glenn asked us if we would like to take part in a race, and we competed in the district school's regatta and won. Mm. We entered 7 events in our first season and won them all. We thought we were invincible. I was the biggest and the strongest, so I led the team, but I never saw myself as the captain. We were all in it together.
What was the training schedule like?
We trained every day after school, and sometimes at lunchtime in school as well, doing weights and stuff like that. Glenn made it all seem like fun. It was never a chore. He was cunning. Sometimes, when we had to do a run around the block, we didn't always go the full distance. He knew what was going on, but never said anything. Instead, next time, he'd take us in his car and drop us off somewhere so that we had no alternative but to run all the way back to school or the rowing club. Afterwards, he always dropped us off at our houses so we could get our homework done ready for the next school day.
So, what was the secret of his success?
The reason we did so well, I later discovered, was that we did more training than any of the other competitors. During the season, we rowed every weekday, had Saturdays off, and then rowed on Sunday mornings. During the winter, we went training with a local rowing club, Tuesday and Thursday evenings. Glenn Johnson taught us discipline. People like doing things they're good at, and that are fun. And the professional way he organised things to make it easy for us, and fun as well, was impressive. In the coaching I do now, I hope I come across in the same way, trying to get people to achieve their potential without flogging them so they hate it and never want to come back to sport once they finish school.
Are you still in contact with him?
Yes. Glenn and I became friends and are still in touch. I see him regularly at school reunions, and sometimes we meet for lunch. He's a great guy. He's been retired for some time now, but he doesn't look any different from when I started rowing in 1976.
Thanks, Harry, for coming in and talking to me today.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part 3. Listen to this short radio programme on cycling in London and Copenhagen. Write no more than 3 words or a number in each space. First, you have 1 minute to read the notes. Now listen and complete the notes. In the last few years, more and more Londoners are choosing to cycle to work, to the shops, or to visit friends and family. Since 2000, there has been a 70% increase in cycling on major roads. This is probably one of the highest growths in cycling anywhere in the world in such a short time. This trend is mirrored throughout the country. Nationwide, the number of people using national cycle networks last year increased by 15% to 232 million journeys. What is the reason behind the resurgence of the bicycle? In London, one reason has been the implementation of the congestion charge, a tax which is charged on all vehicles entering central London. This has definitely reduced traffic volume and has helped to make cycling more pleasant. But central London is only part of London, so it is not the whole picture. It's obviously a part of London where people commute to work, so that does help. But the congestion charge has made a psychological difference to people. It gave the message to people that going by private car or struggling into work on public transport was maybe not the cleverest way anymore. Drivers have also become more tolerant now. Motorists now see things such as advanced stop lines for cyclists at traffic lights. They see the picture of bikes painted on the road, and this gives them the subliminal message that cyclists have priority. They have the right to be in that road space. This makes a huge difference. London taxi drivers and bus drivers, that is, people who are professional drivers, take the greatest care around cyclists. However, the people who do not drive every day are the ones that tend to be more aggressive towards cyclists and drive more dangerously sometimes. The perception of cycling is also changing. We have been through decades when cycling was perceived as poor people's mode of travel, almost second-class citizenship, and in effect, it was almost planned out of existence by traffic engineers and road planners. We have moved a long way from that position. Now cycling is perceived as almost cool. It is desirable. People are interested in it, and people are talking about it. There are even columns in the newspapers devoted to it. But companies could do more to encourage cycling to work. Surveys show that 10 to 25% of Londoners are prepared to cycle to work if the conditions are right. Yet most companies do not have a place to leave bikes. Businesses need to increase parking for bicycles and put in shower facilities for their workforce. Other people need to play their part in this. The authorities also need to provide better facilities on the road for cyclists and get more information out to people who want to cycle. While the increasing number of cyclists in London and the country as a whole is very promising, it does not begin to match what they have achieved in Copenhagen. In Copenhagen, cycling is the norm. Between 100 and 150,000 people use bikes there. What is it about Copenhagen that makes them want to use their bikes? One reason is the convenience. You can park your bike almost anywhere. The local government has made the city very friendly to cyclists and less friendly to cars. But there are still pedestrians, cars, pickup trucks, motorbikes and lorries in the city. Cycle lanes are raised off the road by 2 to 3 inches. There is the road, and then the cycle lane, which is like a broad pavement, about 7 feet wide. Then there is another raised section with a pavement for pedestrians. So everybody is demarcated, and there are blue lanes across central sections and crossroads which show the route that cyclists are supposed to take. Riding a bike in Copenhagen feels pretty safe. It is impressive how they have managed to integrate everything, to get everything to coexist. It has been a very difficult balancing act, but the people of Copenhagen have helped. Danish people are very practical people. The country has the highest taxation on cars, not only in Europe, but probably in the world. So a car is extremely expensive in Denmark, and that, of course, means that a person has to earn a certain level of income in order to be able to afford a car. For many people, it is not practical to use a car to get around the city, and that is why over 40% of the people in Copenhagen use their bike every day. There is also a tradition of bike riding in the city. For generations, people have been brought up to cycle. They are put on bikes at the age of 4 or 5, and they stick with it. Also, Copenhagen was not a wealthy city, and the bike was the form of transport for ordinary people. So, if after a hard day's work at the factory or shipyard, you wanted to have some leisure time, you invested in a bicycle to enjoy the green spaces and coastline near Copenhagen. Next week, we shall examine the role of the bicycle in China. Now listen a second time and check your answers. In the last few years, more and more Londoners are choosing to cycle to work, to the shops, or to visit friends and family. Since 2000, there has been a 70% increase in cycling on major roads. This is probably one of the highest growths in cycling anywhere in the world in such a short time. This trend is mirrored throughout the country. Nationwide, the number of people using national cycle networks last year increased by 15% to 232 million journeys. What is the reason behind the resurgence of the bicycle? In London, one reason has been the implementation of the congestion charge, a tax which is charged on all vehicles entering central London. This has definitely reduced traffic volume and has helped to make cycling more pleasant. But central London is only part of London, so it is not the whole picture. It's obviously a part of London where people commute to work, so that does help. But the congestion charge has made a psychological difference to people. It gave the message to people that going by private car or struggling into work on public transport was maybe not the cleverest way anymore. Drivers have also become more tolerant now. Motorists now see things such as advanced stop lines for cyclists at traffic lights. They see the picture of bikes painted on the road, and this gives them the subliminal message that cyclists have priority. They have the right to be in that road space. This makes a huge difference. London taxi drivers and bus drivers, that is, people who are professional drivers, take the greatest care around cyclists. However, the people who do not drive every day are the ones that tend to be more aggressive towards cyclists and drive more dangerously sometimes. The perception of cycling is also changing. We have been through decades when cycling was perceived as poor people's mode of travel, almost second-class citizenship, and in effect, it was almost planned out of existence by traffic engineers and road planners. We have moved a long way from that position. Now cycling is perceived as almost cool. It is desirable. People are interested in it, and people are talking about it. There are even columns in the newspapers devoted to it. But companies could do more to encourage cycling to work. Surveys show that 10 to 25% of Londoners are prepared to cycle to work if the conditions are right, yet most companies do not have a place to leave bikes. Businesses need to increase parking for bicycles and put in shower facilities for their workforce. Other people need to play their part in this. The authorities also need to provide better facilities on the road for cyclists and get more information out to people who want to cycle. While the increasing number of cyclists in London and the country as a whole is very promising, it does not begin to match what they have achieved in Copenhagen. In Copenhagen, cycling is the norm. Between 100 and 150,000 people use bikes there. What is it about Copenhagen that makes them want to use their bikes? One reason is the convenience. You can park your bike almost anywhere. The local government has made the city very friendly to cyclists and less friendly to cars. But there are still pedestrians, cars, pickup trucks, motorbikes and lorries in the city. Cycle lanes are raised off the road by 2 to 3 inches. There is the road, and then the cycle lane, which is like a broad pavement, about 7 feet wide. Then there is another raised section with a pavement for pedestrians. So everybody is demarcated, and there are blue lanes across central sections and crossroads which show the route that cyclists are supposed to take. Riding a bike in Copenhagen feels pretty safe. It is impressive how they have managed to integrate everything, to get everything to coexist. It has been a very difficult balancing act, but the people of Copenhagen have helped. Danish people are very practical people. The country has the highest taxation on cars, not only in Europe, but probably in the world. So a car is extremely expensive in Denmark, and that, of course, means that a person has to earn a certain level of income in order to be able to afford a car. For many people, it is not practical to use a car to get around the city, and that is why over 40% of the people in Copenhagen use their bike every day. There is also a tradition of bike riding in the city. For generations, people have been brought up to cycle. They are put on bikes at the age of 4 or 5, and they stick with it. Also, Copenhagen was not a wealthy city, and the bike was the form of transport for ordinary people. So, if after a hard day's work at the factory or shipyard, you wanted to have some leisure time, you invested in a bicycle to enjoy the green spaces and coastline near Copenhagen. Next week, we shall examine the role of the bicycle in China. That's the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.